I'm Jim Haskell, Senior Portfolio Strategist. In the wake of the COVID-19 crisis, we've built out our framework for understanding economic policy going forward, what we're calling Monetary Policy 3. In short, with interest rates around the world at zero and traditional methods of monetary stimulus now ineffective, policymakers have been forced to turn to coordinated monetary and fiscal policy in order to engineer any hope for sustained recovery. The nature of MP3, with its emphasis on fiscal policy, will be by definition more political and potentially more difficult to interpret, with ups and downs more likely relative to traditional monetary policy. In today's podcast, I sit down with co-CIO Greg Jensen and senior investor Jason Rotenberg to discuss how we're tracking MP3 implementation around the world and to discuss the divergences we're seeing between countries and the challenges policymakers are facing. We hope you enjoy the discussion. Greg, as you've described before, fiscal stimulus funded by central banks, what we're calling Monetary Policy 3, is going to be the primary way for governments to stimulate in this new zero rate environment. Can you give us an update on our tracking of MP3? What are we currently seeing?
Yeah, great, Jim. So we think we're seeing it in full flight. What we had thought about the transition from Monetary Policy 2, which I'll describe in a second, to Monetary Policy 3, taking something like a decade to occur. And because of this crisis, what we've seen is the shift happen rapidly. And from our perspective, we think it's going to be ongoing. Much like the financial crisis brought us to Monetary Policy 2, interest rates hit zero, you get quantitative easing, and you really don't get out of that. That's now in the toolbox, and that's the way monetary policy has been operating since the crisis. Now you go into this phase where basically Monetary Policy 1, the movement of interest rates, doesn't work when you get to interest rates at zero. So you no longer stimulate private credit by lowering interest rates. Monetary Policy 2 is becoming less and less effective because Monetary Policy 2, quantitative easing, the purchases of assets by central banks, has a limit to it, that it basically, it divides, it essentially affects wealthy people most directly. It drives up asset prices and a smaller and smaller effect on the real economy, which naturally leads you to Monetary Policy 3, where you really need to take the purchase of assets by the central bank and have them spent in the real economy by the treasury. We think that's the most logical lever, given the economic circumstances of zero interest rates not being enough to achieve the needed economic outcomes, and that we're likely going to have that for an extended period of time, one way or the other. So what we're seeing is it's happening, right? If you take the US, even in the Great Depression, we never got anywhere near this kind of fiscal response. We're looking at a fiscal, proactive fiscal response of something like 14% of GDP on top of a massive countercyclical response. And that is a huge impact. And that is going on in the midst of the slowdown. And it is the lever through which stimulation is occurring. And you look all across the world, in almost every country, there is an unprecedented amount of asset purchases by the central bank combined with deficit spending. And so we're in it, and getting used to this process, much like most investment processes are used to, let's say, Monetary Policy 1, interest rates going up and down, affecting asset prices, affecting the economy. Similarly, we now all have to adjust to investing in this world. So the traditional boom bust cycle driven by higher and lower interest rates is out. The new boom bust cycle driven by fiscal policy is in, and getting used to that and thinking about that world is really imperative for investors and policymakers.
Jason, Greg is talking about the universal adoption of MP3 around the world. Countries, though, are having very different outcomes. Can you say more about how we're tracking these divergences?
So first, I agree with Greg's starting point, which is that this is the new paradigm, and that we're seeing countries do a massive amount of fiscal because that's the only way to avoid a massive amount of pain. That said, you know, when we look at what's been announced so far and then the difference of the composition of the policies that we're seeing across countries, there are material differences. And so, for example, the packages in the US are much larger, broader, and cover many more of the holes than those that we're seeing in Europe. In Europe, for example, and that is having a huge economic impact. We're seeing that in much stronger rebound in the U.S. than in Europe. We're seeing that in much stronger household spending in the U.S. than in Europe. And you know, and the European programs being more backdated are leading to a much slower recovery. When you shift to the emerging world, the interesting, I think that there's two learnings there. One is that even countries that, you know, we had questions in terms of what their abilities would be, like a Brazil, has done an incredible amount of MP3. So when we look at Brazil, even though their virus situation is bad, that is helping to cushion their contraction. When you compare that to a Mexico or Russia, who they have so far done much less. And so, you know, in the case of Russia, they probably have a stronger ability than Brazil to do it. So while I agree with Greg that ultimately that's the path that most countries will have to follow in order to avoid incredible pain, I think it is very important to measure in real time what is actually happening, because there will be real time differences in outcomes based on what countries are actually doing.
Greg, I want to explore the nature of fiscal policy, because unlike traditional monetary policy, which is, you know, well understood and therefore somewhat predictable, fiscal policy seems so unpredictable because it's so political in nature and you can have these huge differences between countries. So is that right? Or how do you think about this?
Yeah, well, great question. I think it's so critical, right? These differences are huge and they're going to drive differences in market outcomes and economic outcomes. So on the first hand, I think as a alpha provider, this creates a lot of opportunities, because I think the differentials in this policy tool are going to be very large until there's more data and more understanding of how to use it. And like you're also saying, even if there is good data, processing it through the political lens is very difficult. You're seeing that across countries, very strong differences on who should take the losses associated with the coronavirus and the downturn. Should it be on corporate balance sheets? Should the government take it on? How much should individuals take the pain versus governments at large? And those questions and the different answers that different countries are coming to are going to drive major differences. That creates opportunities in markets, I think, and creates some unpredictability. Like what had happened from the 1970s to today with central banks is they converged more or less. Most central banks were operating under a similar template, a similar understanding. And so that led to some degree of predictability. I think you're right that this is much less predictable tool, probably much wider ranges of outcomes as a result, and many failures along the way. Although much like interest rate policy, I think most of the failures will be self-fixing, in the sense that if you get a bad economic outcome because you fail, you get another chance with fiscal policy. And we're seeing that in the current situation. Most of the countries that underdid fiscal relative to what was necessary just came back and did more later. And I do think you'll see that as a consistent pattern for those countries that undershoot what's necessary to create a recovery.
Yeah, that's certainly what we're seeing so far. We can see at the aggregate economic outcomes, even places like the U.S. And Brazil that have been hit pretty hard by the virus are seeing strong pickups, because, you know, there's just the incomes are being supported. And places like Europe that have dealt better with the virus, big shutdowns at first that they're recovering from, the shutdowns without the fiscal were so economically damaging, creating second order effects, that these economies are bouncing back much more slowly. And Europe today is twice as depressed as the US is. And then at the other side of the spectrum, you know, we are seeing still a slower response in a few places. And it'll be interesting to see whether the theory that those places will respond will actually happen. Like Mexico has basically done no fiscal at all, and their economy is one of the weakest in the world, down 15% of GDP. It's hard to imagine that politicians will be able to accept that kind of pain without easing into it in some fashion.
Yeah, although like you said, you still have choices as a society on who will take the pain, right? And you can choose, as Mexico and to some extent Russia are, to take the pain in terms of just a much lower standard of living, less spending. And in countries with smaller corporate balance sheets, that's more plausible. When you have big balance sheets, the loss in income compounds on itself, because you get defaults, the defaults affect other people, et cetera. If you have smaller balance sheets, as you do in Russia in particular, and to some extent Mexico, that spending hit itself can absorb the pain, and you don't end up with the compounding that most major developed economies have
in the fact that they have large balance sheets that need to be dealt with. So I do think that's an important, another important differentiator is how much debt is there, how big are the balance sheets, who holds those balance sheets, and how much can they adjust?
I want to ask you a question, Jason, about government efforts and the sustainability of the relationship between income and spending. If you have these measures coming, you know, whenever it's necessary because benefits are running out, isn't it more likely that households will save the supports they get than if it was more permanent? How important is that going forward?
I think that's a big reason why so far the effects have been largely deflationary. You know, like it's a new thing. You just lost your job and you're getting your income supplemented by the government, right? But once a lot of these supports become more permanent, the willingness of households and businesses to spend will rise over time at a time when you still have significant supply constraints in the economy. And so I think that is a hugely impactful dynamic. Like in the US, for example, the supports have been so large that incomes are actually up despite massive unemployment, and yet spending is still weaker. And so as Congress tops off this first round, and as you look beyond the election, if that gets renewed again, at some point, households will internalize that it will be politically impossible and economically undesirable to pull back these supports, which will both be a positive for growth and also will turn this dynamic a lot more inflationary.
Yeah, and I think just to add to what Jason's saying, I think as you watch this, right, that savings rate on the money is like we try to measure the effectiveness of each fiscal policy and how much will be saved. And even if it is saved, it has impact as well. So you've seen this with the U.S. household money. There's been a very high savings rate on those checks, but they've had significant impact nonetheless because that money has flown into different places where those households save. And so it's building up bank balance sheets in terms of cash on those balance sheets. It's entering asset markets in more extreme speculative ways than we had seen before. So you're seeing those effects. So definitely it would be important, Jim, as you asked, to monitor the savings rate in terms of the impact directly on the economy, as well as the impact they're having on financial assets, which is working the other way. That money being saved is driving up some areas, some pockets in financial markets in a significant way. And if that money gets spent at a higher rate, you'll see money coming out of those things. The relationship between the economy and the markets can be counterintuitive. To some degree, this flood of liquidity when nothing's happening in the real economy has driven asset prices up. The reverse, if you start to get money spent in the economy, the fiscal policy flowing through to the real economy rather than the financial markets, you could see the economy pick up with much less of a rally in asset markets.
So, Greg, those are important points. I want to ask you about the necessity of governments continuing to print more, central banks printing more, and the constraints that that ultimately will create. Can you review again the constraints that you could see on this stimulus and which countries will pop up first and why?
Yeah, well, I think the real constraints in the long term are inflation and currency. So inflation strength and currency weakness are the big concern that if you get those, suddenly policymakers can't get what they want. And they're gonna have to pick between stimulating the economy and dealing with inflation. And I think that's gonna come. So I think that's gonna come sooner than most people expect, but in any event, whether it's 6 months, 18 months from now, or 5 years from now, I think that's the thing to be watching out for. And the next big caution point for markets is going to be when I think inflation is around 4% and the unemployment rate's still high. How this policymakers are going to deal with that is a big question mark. And I would say from everything that I've heard, they don't know yet. They're going to deal with it when they get there. And so I think that's the big caution sign for the economy and for markets. So when will we hit that? We'll see. But that's what I would be watching. Today, break-even inflations are well under those numbers. I think we still have some runway in the reflation before you face that dangerous point. But that's where I'd be concerned and where the limits are really hit. In the meantime, when you have low inflation and weak growth, it's easy. Stimulate as much as you can is the best political answer, is the best policy answer. Everything aligns to do that. Now, you can always have the third thing that Jason really brought up, the third limit, is political functionality that you can have in different countries for
other political reasons, people not believing that believing the government's too corrupt or believing that deficit spending is bad for some other reason, you could hit political limits before that. And you might bump into those. But I believe those will mostly be self-fixing because the impact on the economy will cause other people to get elected and policies to change. So we face that risk to a certain extent in the US. I think if we have divided government, you might have a challenge. And in some other countries, you might have challenges with running larger deficits. But it's really, that will be sort of political conflict leading to dysfunction would be the other reason it doesn't happen. Now, back to your question on which countries are most at risk, I think basically you have three things that put it at risk. One is if you borrow a lot in foreign currency and you have particular need to attract foreign capital, I think you're more at risk going down this path because you have to get it funded from the rest of the world, particularly if you're doing that in foreign currency, very much at risk. So you have the currency risk come in quicker. Countries with higher inflation rates also can run into the challenges faster. So when I look at a country like the UK, probably a little bit more constrained, needs to attract foreign capital, has a higher inflation rate to start with, a little bit more constrained than, let's say, the US with its reserve currency status and its lower inflation rate than the UK. And then countries like Europe and Japan, while they're not doing as much, have a lot of room to do more because their inflation rates are lower and they're not that dependent on foreign capital. So I think you'll see it in the fringes first, kind of looking at Turkey as a fringe example right now, where they need foreign capital, they want to stimulate, they're trying to ease and stimulate and struggling to do so, having a massive currency impact because it's very difficult if you have those challenges. And so they're hitting the wall first. I think you'll see it flow through weaker and weaker balance sheet countries over time in terms of hitting that wall and then having to choose between currency and inflation and the economy and have struggling to do so.
Greg, I want to turn to what the forward picture will look like. When we think about traditional monetary policy, it's about stimulating or destimulating credit and therefore influencing the cycle. As inflation rises, central banks tighten by raising interest rates, that raises the cost of capital, so growth falls. Central banks then reverse course and ease. Growth ultimately recovers, and we just sort of rinse and repeat. Now, as we look at MP3, should we expect the cycle to work in a similar way? And if not, what are the characteristics of this new cycle?
Yeah, I think so. Certainly up until we have the breakdown that we were talking about before of some sort of inflation or currency problem, I think you see a somewhat similar cycle, but much more choppy, right? If you even more conceptualize the cycle from the traditional monetary policy cycle, it basically looks like this. There's some pain in the economy, pain and suffering, and then the government tries to do something using the tools they have to do it. And then that has an effect that generally leads in the opposite direction, and that rinses and repeats. Now, the tool used to be interest rates. Before that, it was a gold standard and coming off the gold standard. And so there's been different versions of economic pain leading to government reaction, leading to an effect in the economy, and so on and so forth. So I do think you should expect that to continue as it's occurred through many, many different types of policy in history. But I think unlike the credit cycle, which over the last 40 years was honed, and there was a very fast reaction and over time, a better and better reaction by central banks to economic conditions and more consistency on what the targets would be. Here, much more wide range on what to do, how much to do, what you're trying to accomplish. So what I think if you saw over time, there become more institutions like the Fed making these decisions. And some economies are set up for that with infrastructure banks and other ways where you have an institutional ability to respond to economic conditions. It would work more consistently like the credit cycle does. But in most countries, the by and large of the fiscal part is it's still super political. There isn't an institutional way to do it. So it'll be more choppy, probably require more pain to get the response. And really this COVID crisis, because it created so much pain, led very quickly to these responses. The more normal kind of ups and downs in economy will probably be accelerated because this policy will take a while to create the response. It won't be as kind of ongoing as a central bank response. It'll be more choppy.
Greg, Jason, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, Jim.